3.1 There was pain, there was fear, there was confusion. Two virgins deflowering each other with no more than the dimmest understanding of what they were up to. Prepared only in the sense that Ferguson had managed to procure a box of condoms and that Amy, anticipating the blood that would inevitably flow out of her, had put a dark brown bath towel over the bottom sheet of her bed. Precaution inspired by the enduring power of old legends, and which in fact proved unnecessary. Joy to begin with, the ecstatic sensation of being entirely naked with each other for the first time since their long-forgotten mattress romp as small children. The chance to touch every square centimeter of the other's body, the delirium of bare skin pressing against bare skin. But once they were fully aroused, the difficulty of advancing to the next step, the anxiety of entering another person for the first time, of being entered by another person for the first time. Amy tensing up in those first instants because it hurt so much. Ferguson feeling wretched for causing that hurt and therefore slowing down and ultimately withdrawing altogether. After which there was a 3-minute timeout, and then Amy grabbed hold of Ferguson and instructed him to begin again, saying, "Just do it, Archie. Don't worry about me. Just do it." And so Ferguson did it, knowing he couldn't not worry about her, but also knowing that the line had to be crossed, that this was the moment they had been given, and in spite of the inner bruising that must have made her feel as if she were being torn apart, Amy laughed when it was over, laughed her big laugh and said, "I'm so happy, I think I could die." What a strange weekend it was, never once leaving the apartment, as they sat on the sofa and watched Johnson being sworn in as the new president. Watched Oswald being carted off to jail in his bloodied T-shirt, protesting to the cameras that he was nothing but a patsy, a word that Ferguson would forever associate with the frail young man who either killed or didn't kill Kennedy on his own. Watched a brief respite from the news when an orchestra played the dirge from Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. Watched the funeral procession through the streets of Washington on Sunday as Amy choked up at the sight of the riderless horse. And watched Jack Ruby slip into the Dallas police station and shoot Oswald in the stomach. Unreal City. The line from Elliot kept exploding in Ferguson's head throughout those 3 days as he and Amy gradually ate up the food in the kitchen. The eggs, the lamb chops, the sliced turkey, the packages of cheese, the cans of tuna fish, the boxes of breakfast cereal and cookies. Amy smoking more than he had ever seen her smoke, and Ferguson smoking with her for the first time since they had met. The two of them sitting on the sofa together and stubbing out their luckies in unison, then throwing their arms around each other and kissing, unable to stop themselves from committing the sacrilege of kissing at such a solemn moment, from leaving the sofa every 3 or 4 hours for another visit to the bedroom, shedding their clothes and climbing onto the bed again. Both of them sore now, not just Amy, but Ferguson as well. But they couldn't stop themselves. The pleasure was always stronger than the pain. And grim as it was to be there on such a miserable weekend, it was the biggest, most important weekend of their young lives. The pity was that no more chances came their way for the next 2 months. Ferguson kept going to New York every Saturday, but Amy's apartment was never empty long enough for them to return to the bedroom. One of her parents was always around, often both of her parents. And with nowhere else for them to go, the only solution was for the Schneidermans to leave town again, which they didn't. That was why Ferguson accepted his cousin's invitation to go on the skiing trip to Vermont in late January. Not that he had any interest in skiing, which he had tried once and felt no need to try again, but when Francie told him that the only house they had been able to rent for the weekend was a sprawling old place with 5 bedrooms, Ferguson thought there might be some hope. "Plenty of room," Francie said, which explained why she had thought of calling him. And if he wanted to bring along a friend, there would be room for that person as well. "Do girlfriends count as friends?" Ferguson asked. "Of course they do," Francie said. And from the way she replied to his question, from the spontaneous enthusiasm of that ringing "of course," Ferguson naturally supposed she understood he was telling her that he and Amy were a couple now and wanted to sleep in the same bedroom. For Francie had been married at 18, after all, just 1 year older than Amy was now, and if anyone knew about thwarted teenage lust, it had to be his 27-year-old cousin, who had been his favorite cousin ever since he was in diapers. Amy was dubious about Ferguson's optimistic reading of Francie's "of course," knowing how far the two of them had strayed from the accepted rules of sexual conduct, which not only didn't allow for intercourse between unmarried teenagers, but considered it to be a positive scandal. But still, she said, she had never been to Vermont, had never been on skis, and what could be better than a weekend in the snow with Archie? As for the other business, they would just have to see who was right and who was wrong, and if it turned out she was right, that didn't mean there couldn't be some late-night room-hopping for a silent crawl into someone else's bed. They left on a cold Friday afternoon as Amy and Ferguson wedged themselves into a cramped blue station wagon with Francie, her husband Gary, and the two Hollander children, 6-year-old Rosa and 4-year-old David, and it was a lucky thing for the big ones that the little ones slept for most of the 5 hours it took them to reach Stowe. Francie had named her daughter after Ferguson's mother, even though the names were not identical. The injunction against giving children the names of living parents, grandparents, and relatives was a law that even non-practicing Jews still followed, which accounted for the one-letter difference between Rose and Rosa, a subtle point that Gary the lawyer had come up with in order to outflank the traditionalists in his family. But nevertheless, the name was there for everyone to see, Rosa, in honor of Rose. And with that gesture, Francie and Gary were telling the world they had turned their backs on Arnold Ferguson, who had broken apart the family with the crime he had committed against his brother, and henceforth their loyalties would be shifted over to that brother, victim Stanley, and his wife Rose, whom Francie had loved from the moment she first set eyes on her as a young girl. It wasn't easy for Francie to take that step, to denounce her father when she still felt so close to her mother, brother, and sister. But Gary's contempt for his father-in-law was so strong, his disgust at the man's moral weakness and dishonesty was so absolute, that Francie had little choice but to go along with her husband. They had already been married for 2 years when the robbery took place. Living in northwestern Massachusetts, as Gary finished his undergraduate work at Williams, one of the three baby couples in his class, and the 20-year-old Francie was already pregnant with her own first baby, who was born several months after her father's involvement in the warehouse clean-out came to light. The rest of the family had all moved to California by then, not just her parents, but the docile young Ruth as well, who had just finished high school and was enrolled in a secretarial course in L.A., and even Jack, who dropped out of Rutgers in his last year to join them, a decision Francie and Gary urged him not to make, which led to Jack telling them both to fuck off. And by the time Rosa was born, only Francie's mother and sister made the trip back east to hold the child in their arms. Jack said he was too busy to come, and the disgraced Arnold Ferguson couldn't come, because he could never come back east again. Francie had suffered then, no more or no less than anyone else in the family, perhaps, but each one had suffered in his or her own way. And as far as Ferguson could tell, Francie's suffering had turned her into a quieter, less ebullient person than she had once been, a duller version of her former self. On the other hand, she was getting older now, already past the point of what Ferguson liked to call a fully grown grown-up, and even if her marriage seemed to be a good one, there was no question that Gary could be pompous and overbearing at times, more and more given to long, blowhard monologues about the decline and fall of Western civilization, especially now that he had been with his father's firm for the past couple of years and was starting to earn big man lawyer money, which must have worn her down to some degree, not to mention motherhood, which wore down everyone, even a caring and affectionate mother like Francie, who lived for her children in the same way Aunt Joan had once lived for hers. No, Ferguson said to himself as the station wagon headed north through the gathering darkness, he mustn't exaggerate. Even if life had kicked her around a little bit, Francie was still the same old Francie, the same magic cousin of his early boyhood. Somewhat hobbled now, he supposed, burdened as she was by the memory of her father's betrayal. But how happy she had sounded when he accepted her invitation for the weekend, and how generous of her to have included Amy with that surprising, "of course." And now that they were all sitting in the car together, Ferguson in the back with the two sleeping children, and Francie up front between Gary and Amy, he could see his cousin's still beautiful face in the rearview mirror every time the headlights of a passing car shone into it. And one of those times, about halfway through the trip, when she glanced up and saw that he was looking at her, she turned around, stretched out her left arm, and took hold of his hand, which she then gave a long, hard squeeze. "Everything okay?" she asked. "You're awfully quiet back there." It was true that he hadn't said much in the past hour, but that was only because he hadn't wanted to wake the children, and therefore his mind had been wandering, floating around among ancient family matters, as he stopped listening to what Amy and Gary were talking about up front, his body lulled by the rumbling of the tires below him, the old blur-in-the-head car sensation as they moved along at 60 miles an hour. But now that Francie had squeezed his hand and he was starting to pay closer attention, he gathered that the issue was politics, above all the assassination, which had happened just 2 months earlier, and was still the subject no one could stop talking about. The obsessive conversations about who and why and how, since it scarcely seemed credible that Oswald had done it alone, and numerous alternative theories had already begun to circulate. Castro, the mob, the CIA, and even Johnson himself, the big-nosed Texan who had succeeded the man of the future. Still an X-factor as far as Amy was concerned, but Gary, who had been quick to make up his mind, called him a slippery character, an old-style backroom politician who wasn't up to the job, and Amy, though she acknowledged he could have been right, nevertheless countered by bringing up Johnson's speech from earlier that month, the announcement of the war against poverty, which was the best presidential speech of her lifetime, she said, and he had to admit that no one had ever stood up and said something like that since Roosevelt, not even Kennedy. Ferguson smiled as he heard Gary concede the point, and then his mind drifted away again as he started thinking about Amy, remarkable Amy, who was making such a big hit with the Hollanders, who had won them over with the first handshake, the first hello, just as she had won him over at the Labor Day barbecue. And now that they were approaching the Vermont border, he could only pray that everything would work out as planned, that it wouldn't be long before the two of them were naked together under the covers again, in a strange room, in a strange house, in the middle of a New England nowhere. The house was as big as advertised, and nowhere was the top of a hill that stood about 10 miles from the ski resort, 3 stories instead of the customary 2. Their weekend digs had been built sometime in the early 19th century, and every floorboard in that drafty wooden structure creaked. The creaking was a potential problem, since it turned out that Amy's interpretation of Francie's "of course" had been the correct one, something Ferguson was obliged to admit when the 6-person party made its first tour of the house, understanding that their hosts had never considered allowing them to sleep together in the same room, and therefore they would have to go with their backup plan, which Ferguson referred to as the French farce solution, the midnight frolics of doors opening and shutting on rusty hinges, of lovers creeping down darkened, unfamiliar hallways, of bodies crawling into beds they weren't supposed to be in, and groaning floorboards were not going to aid them in their deceptions. Fortunately, Gary and Francie suggested that the big kids sleep in the 2 attic bedrooms so the little kids could spend the night on the same floor as their parents, who would be nearby in case of a bad dream, Rosa, or a bedwetting incident, David. That would help, Ferguson thought. The creaking floorboards would be right on top of the others, of course, resonating throughout the ceilings below, but then again, people sometimes left their beds in the thick of night to stumble off to the bathroom, and in an old house like this one, who could prevent the floors from making their horror movie sound effects? With any luck, they would be able to pull it off. And if they had no luck, what was the worst that could happen to them? Nothing much, Ferguson said to himself, perhaps nothing at all. For the first little while, everything went smoothly. They had arranged the tryst for 11:30. A full 90 minutes after the children had been tucked in and their weary parents had said good night, and at the appointed hour all was still in the house except for an occasional gust of wind pouring through the fissured walls and rattling the weather vane overhead. Planting his bare feet on the floor, Ferguson stood up from the iron cot and began the slow journey toward Amy's room, tiptoeing cautiously over the loose planks, halting after any and all squeaks emitted by the wood, then counting to 5 before hazarding the next step. He had left the door ajar to avoid having to turn the knob, which eliminated the risk of creating a sudden, too loud noise from the latch, and while the hinges were indeed a bit rusty, they proved to be quieter than the wind. Next, the hallway, with the 14 additional steps that phase of the journey required, and then the gentle push against Amy's door, which had been left ajar as well, and at last he was in. The bed was exceedingly narrow, but Amy was naked in that bed, and once he stripped off his jockey shorts and slipped in beside her, Ferguson was naked in that bed too. And everything felt so good to him, so perfectly in accord with how he imagined it would feel, that for once in his life, the real and the imagined were identical, absolutely and as never before, one and the same thing, which had to make it the happiest moment of his life so far, he believed, since Ferguson was not someone who subscribed to the notion that desire fulfilled was desire disappointed, at least not in this case, where wanting Amy was no good now without having Amy, no good without having Amy want him. And the miracle was that she did want him, and therefore desire fulfilled was, in fact, desire fulfilled, the chance to spend a few moments in the ephemeral kingdom of earthly grace. They had learned so much during that tumultuous weekend 2 months earlier, fumbling at first because they had known next to nothing about almost everything, but gradually achieving a certain knowledge about what they were trying to do. Not an advanced knowledge, perhaps, but at least the rudiments of how the other's body worked. For without that knowledge, there could be no true pleasure, especially for Amy, who had to teach the ignorant Ferguson about the various ways in which women differed from men. And now that Ferguson was beginning to get the hang of it, he felt calmer and more confident than he had in New York, which made everything better this time, so much better that after a few minutes in the pitch-black dark of that room in Vermont, they had stopped thinking about where they were. The bed was an old iron bed with a thin mattress poised on top of 2 dozen coiled springs. And like the wooden floor that supported the bed, it creaked. It creaked under the weight of one body, but when two bodies began to move around on that mattress together, it thundered. The noise made Ferguson think of a steam locomotive traveling at 70 miles an hour, whereas Amy found the noise similar to the one made by a printing press churning out 500,000 copies for the morning edition of a tabloid newspaper. Either way, the noise was too loud for the delicate French farce they had written in their heads, and now that they had begun to hear the noise, there was no longer anything in their heads but the noise, the infernal screech of their frantic coupling. And yet how to stop themselves when they were on the brink, tottering on the very precipice of desire fulfilled? They couldn't, and therefore the two of them went on until they had both fallen off the edge. And when the locomotive stopped moving and they could hear something other than the noise, they heard another noise coming from the floor below, the wail of a startled, frightened child, no doubt the little one, David, who had been jolted from sleep by the ruckus they had made upstairs. And a moment after that, they heard the sound of footsteps, no doubt Francie's, Mother Francie going in to comfort her boy as Father Gary snored on, at which point the horrified and embarrassed Ferguson leapt out of Amy's bed and scampered back to his room, and thus the curtain came thudding down on their grand boulevard entertainment. At 7:30 the next morning, Ferguson walked into the kitchen and found Rosa and David sitting at the table, banging the surface with knives and forks, as they cried out in unison, "We want pancakes! We want pancakes!" Gary was sitting across from them, quietly drinking a cup of coffee and smoking his first Parliament of the day. Francie, on her feet by the stove, flashed an irritated look at her cousin, and then returned to the job of cooking scrambled eggs. Amy was nowhere in sight, which probably meant she was still asleep in her little bed upstairs. Gary put down his coffee and said, "We promised them pancakes yesterday, but then we forgot to pack the stuff to make them with. As you can see, they're not too happy with the idea of scrambled eggs." Red-headed Rosa and blonde-haired David continued to attack the table with their knives and forks, timing the blows to the drumbeat of their favorite chant, "We want pancakes." "There must be a store somewhere around here," Ferguson said. "Down the hill, then left for 3 or 4 miles," Gary answered, blowing out a large puff of smoke that seemed to suggest he had no intention of driving there himself. "I'll go," Francie said, as she transferred the now finished eggs from the frying pan into a large white bowl. "Archie and I will go together, won't we, Archie?" "Anything you say," Ferguson replied, somewhat startled by the vehemence of Francie's question, which didn't sound like a question so much as a command. She was angry at him. First, the hostile look when he walked into the kitchen, and now the aggressive tone in her voice, which could only mean she was still thinking about last night's attic commotion, the damned locomotive bed that had blasted the little one awake on the second floor, an inexcusable offense he had hoped she would tactfully pretend to have forgotten. And although Ferguson knew he should apologize to her right then and there, he was too embarrassed to say a word. Going out to buy pancake mix and maple syrup had nothing to do with appeasing the children. That was her excuse, but the real motive was to get him alone with her for a little while, in order to scold him, to have it out with him. Meanwhile, the children were clapping and cheering, celebrating their victory by blowing kisses to their valiant mother, who was about to brave the cold and the snow on their behalf. Gary, who seemed oblivious to what was going on, or at least indifferent to it, put out his cigarette and dug into the scrambled eggs. After one bite, he filled up his fork again and held it out to David, who leaned forward and took it into his mouth. Then a forkful for Rosa, followed by another forkful for himself. "Pretty good," he said, "don't you think?" "Yummy," said Rosa. "Yummy in the tummy," said David, who laughed at his own joke, and then opened his mouth for another bite. Watching this scene as he laced up his boots and put on his winter jacket, Ferguson thought of 2 infant birds at feeding time. "Worms or scrambled eggs," he said to himself. The hunger was the same hunger, and the open mouths were the same open mouths, stretched open as far as they could go. Pancakes, yes, but first a little something to get the morning off to a good start. There were real birds outside, a speckled brown sparrow, an olive-green female cardinal with a dull scarlet crest, a red-winged blackbird, sudden splotches of color darting across the white-gray sky, a few bits of breathing life in the austere winter morning. And as Ferguson and his cousin crossed the snow-covered yard and climbed into the blue station wagon, he found it a pity that the weekend was about to be spoiled by a senseless argument. He and Francie had never argued in all the years they had known each other. Not one unkind word had ever passed between them. Their mutual devotion had been constant and unbending, the one deep friendship he had formed with any relative on that side of the family, the fractured clan of crazy, destructive Fergusons. Only he and Francie, among all the cousins and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, had been able to avoid those stupid animosities, and it pained him to think she might turn on him now. It was a cold morning, but not exceptionally cold for that time of year, 4 or 5 notches below freezing, and the engine kicked over with the first turn of the key. As they sat there, waiting for the car to warm up, Ferguson asked if she would prefer that he do the driving instead. He wouldn't have his license until he turned 17 in another 6 weeks or so, but he had his learner's permit, and given that she was a licensed driver who happened to be in the car with him, it was perfectly legal for them to switch places. Ferguson added that he was a good driver, and for many months now his parents had been letting him handle the chauffeuring duties whenever he had to go somewhere with them, either singly or together, and neither his mother nor his father had ever complained about the results. Francie smiled a tight little smile and said she was sure he was an excellent driver, probably a better driver than she was, But she was behind the wheel now, and they were about to get started, and going down the hill could be a bit tricky for someone who had never driven on a dirt road, and so she would do the driving, thank you, and once they got to the store and bought the things they needed to buy, maybe they could switch places for the ride back home. As it happened, there was no ride back home. They couldn't return from Miller's General Store because they never managed to reach the store. And on that morning, which Ferguson would always think of as the morning of mornings, both cousins paid a price for that interrupted journey in the mountains of Vermont, especially Ferguson, who wound up paying for it long into the future. And while no one held him responsible for the accident, how could he be responsible if he wasn't driving the car? He nevertheless blamed himself for causing Francie to turn her eyes from the road, for if she hadn't glanced over to look at him instead, she never would have skidded on that patch of ice and crashed into the tree. The point was that he knew better than to allow himself to be drawn into the argument. Francie had every right to feel annoyed with him, and he decided the best course of action would be to say as little as possible to her, to nod his head and agree with whatever harsh judgment she pronounced on him, to resist the temptation to defend himself. Let her be angry, he thought, but as long as he could prevent that anger from inciting an anger of his own, perhaps the confrontation would be short and small and soon forgotten. Or so Ferguson thought. His mistake was to assume that the central issue was the noise, the indiscretion of that noise and the selfishness he had shown by inflicting it on the others. But the noise was only part of it, the least part of it, and once he understood that the attack was far bigger than the one he had prepared himself for, he was caught with his guard down, and when Francie lashed out at him, he lashed back at her. She managed to navigate the cart down the mile-long hill without any trouble. But when she came to the bottom and paused, she turned right instead of left. And since Gary had said the store was to the left, Ferguson mentioned it to her. But Francie merely strummed her fingers on the steering wheel and said not to worry about it. Gary had no sense of direction. He was always mixing things up. And if he said they should go left, that must have meant they should go right. It was a funny thing to say, Ferguson thought. But the words didn't sound funny when they came out of Francie's mouth. They sounded bitter and slightly contemptuous, as if Francie were peeved at Gary about something, or peeved at someone else about some other thing, her brother Jack, for instance, who was rarely in touch with her anymore, or her pain-in-the-neck father, who had just lost another job and was on unemployment again, or perhaps all three men at the same time, which would have made Ferguson the fourth man she was on the outs with that morning. And the fact that she had indeed taken the wrong turn and was driving farther and farther away from the store didn't help to soften her mood when she discovered her mistake, which meant that the second half of the interrupted journey was spent on a series of twisting back roads in search of a route back to the county highway where they had started, and in the frazzle of bad temper and frustration that descended upon his normally uncombative first cousin, Francie finally got down to the business that had prompted them to leave the house in the first place and let him have it. How sad, she said, how sad and disappointing it was to discover that her darling boy had turned into a lying cheat, that he was just another crumb in a long line of crumbs, and how dare he use her in the way he had, dragging his girlfriend up to Vermont in order to fuck her behind everyone's back. It was disgusting. Two horny kids, charming everyone on the ride up, and then sneaking around in the attic at night, fucking on top of two little children. And how could he do this to her? She, who had loved him since the day he was born. She, who had bathed him and cared for him and watched him grow up. And what was she supposed to say to his mother, who had let him go to Vermont because she knew he would be safe with his cousin? There was trust involved in all this, she said. And how could he break that trust under her very roof? An out-of-control teenager who couldn't even keep it in his pants for one night. And the truth was, she didn't want him there anymore. She would put him and his slut girlfriend on the bus this afternoon and send them back to New York, and goodbye and good riddance to them both. That was the beginning. 5 minutes later, she was still talking, and when Ferguson finally told her to shut up and stop the car, shouting that he'd had enough and would walk back to the house to fetch his things, Francie turned to him and said, with something like madness in her eyes, "Don't be ridiculous, Archie. You'll freeze to death out there." Which convinced him that something was wrong with her, that her mind was wobbling, on the verge of cracking up, and because she went on looking at him, as if she no longer remembered what she had just been saying, he smiled at her, and when she smiled back at him, he realized that she had stopped looking at the road, and a moment later the car slammed into the tree. No seat belts, not in 1964, and consequently they were both injured in the crash, even though the car had been traveling at a moderate speed, somewhere between 30 and 35 miles an hour. Francie, a concussion, a broken left clavicle caused by the impact when she was flung forward into the steering wheel. And once she was released from the Vermont hospital, transferred to a New Jersey hospital to recover from what the doctors told Gary was a nervous breakdown. Ferguson, unconscious and bleeding from his head, his arms, and his left hand, which had gone through the windshield first, and while no bones were broken, a long odds fluke that confounded the staff and inspired some of the nurses to call it a medical miracle. Two of the fingers on that left hand were severed by the windshield glass, both joints of the thumb and the top two joints of the index, and because the fingers were buried in the snow and not recovered until spring, Ferguson was fated to march through the rest of his life as an eight-fingered man. He took it hard. He knew he should be glad he wasn't dead, but his survival was a fact, something that no longer had to be questioned. And the question before him now was not so much a question as a cry of despair. What was going to happen to him? He had been deformed, and when they removed the bandages and showed him what his hand looked like, what it would always look like from now on, he was revolted by what he saw. His hand was no longer his hand. It belonged to someone else, and as he gazed down at the stitched-up, smoothed-over spots that had once been his thumb and index finger, he felt sick and turned his head away. So ugly, so hideous to look at, the hand of a monster. He had joined the brigade of the damned, he told himself, and from now on he would be looked upon as one of those crippled, distorted people who no longer counted as full-fledged members of the human race. And then, to compound the agony of those insidious humiliations, there would be the trial of having to relearn 100 things he had mastered as a small boy, the myriad manipulations that a two-thumbed person performed unconsciously every day, how to tie his shoes, how to button his shirt, how to cut his food, how to use a typewriter, and until those tasks became automatic for him again, which could take months, perhaps even years, he would be constantly reminded of how far he had fallen. No, Ferguson wasn't dead, but other words beginning with the letter D clung to him like a flock of starving children in the days that followed the accident, and he found it impossible to free himself from the spell of those emotions. Demoralized, depressed, dumbfounded, discouraged, dejected, down in the dumps, desperate, defensive, despondent, discombobulated, distressed, deranged, defeated. His greatest fear was that Amy would stop loving him. Not that she would want to, and not that she would even understand her own feelings, but how could anyone enjoy being touched by that maimed and disfigured hand? It would turn a person's stomach, it would kill all desire, and little by little the revulsion would mount until she started to back away from him, and eventually let him go. And if he lost Amy, not only would his heart be broken, but his life would be ruined forever. For what woman in her right mind could possibly be attracted to a man like him, a pitiable, mutilated creature who walked around with a claw jutting from his left arm instead of a hand? Endless sorrow, endless loneliness, endless disappointment. That would be his lot. And even as Amy sat with him in the hospital throughout the weekend, and then cut school to stay with him through Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, stroking his face and telling him that everything would be exactly as it had been before, that losing a couple of fingers was a rotten blow but hardly the end of the world, that millions of people lived with far worse and forged on bravely without giving it a second thought. And even as Ferguson listened to her and watched her face as she talked to him. He wondered if he wasn't looking at an apparition, a substitute Amy who was going through the motions of the real Amy, and if he shut his eyes for a couple of seconds, he wondered if she wouldn't disappear before he had a chance to open them again. His parents had left Montclair to be with him as well, and they were wonderfully kind to him, just as Amy was wonderfully kind to him, just as the doctors and nurses were wonderfully kind to him. And yet how could any of them know what he was feeling? How could they understand that, contrary to what they all kept telling him, it was indeed the end of the world, at least the little part of the world that had belonged to him? And how could he open up to them about the devastation he felt whenever he thought about baseball, the dumbest game ever invented, according to the long-gone Anne-Marie Dumartin? But how deeply he still loved it, and how much he had been looking forward to the first indoor varsity practices, which were scheduled to begin in mid-February, and now the baseball part of his world had ended as well, for he would never be able to hold a bat again with those two fingers missing from his left hand, not in the proper way, not in the way he needed to hold it to swing with power. And how could he control a glove that had been designed for five fingers with only three fingers? He would be cast down into mediocrity if he tried to play with his handicap, and that would be unacceptable to him, especially now, when he had been preparing himself for the season of his life, an all-conference, all-county, all-state kind of season, causing such a stir that the pro scouts would start coming to watch the wizard at third base with a .400 batting average, which would lead to an eventual signing with a major league club, thus making him the first baseball-playing poet in the annals of American sport, winner of both the Pulitzer Prize and the Most Valuable Player Award. And because he had never dared to confess this fantastical daydream to anyone, he couldn't begin now. Not when he found himself on the brink of tears every time he thought about returning to Montclair and telling his coach he could no longer play on the team, holding up his miserable left hand to demonstrate why his career was over. At which point the terse, undemonstrative Sal Martino would nod his head in commiseration, mumbling a few short words that would come out more or less as follows: "Tough break, kid. We're going to miss you." Amy and his father both left on Thursday morning, but his mother stayed with him until he was discharged from the hospital, sleeping in a nearby motel and traveling around in a small rented car. The extremity of her compassion was almost too much for him, the sympathetic maternal eyes that kept watching him and telling him how deeply his suffering had become her suffering. And yet because she understood how much he disliked it when she fussed and doted, he was thankful to her for not dwelling on his injuries, for not offering any advice, for not encouraging him to buck up, for not shedding any tears. He knew what a frightful mess he was and how painful it must have been for her to look at him. Not only the still healing sutures on his left hand, which were still red and raw and swollen, but also the bandages wrapped around his forearms, temporarily masking the 64 stitches that had closed up his gouged flesh, and the weird patches of shorn hair dotting his scalp, where more stitches had been applied to the worst cuts and gashes. But none of those future scars seemed to disturb her. The only thing that mattered was that he had come through the accident with his face intact, which again and again she called a blessing, the one lucky turn in this whole unlucky business. And while Ferguson was in no mood to count his blessings just then, he understood her point, since there was a hierarchy of destruction to be reckoned with, and living with a destroyed hand was far less terrible than living with a destroyed face. It was hard to admit to himself how much he wanted his mother to be there with him. Every time she sat down in the chair next to his bed, things felt a little better than they were when he was alone, often vastly better, and yet he still held back from confiding in her. He couldn't quite bring himself to tell her how afraid he was when he thought about his stunted, abysmal future, the long years of loveless desolation that stood in front of him, all the childish, self-pitying fears that would have sounded so inane if he had spoken them out loud. And so he continued to say next to nothing about himself, and his mother didn't press him to say more. In the long run, It probably didn't make any difference if he talked or not, since it was all but certain that she already knew what he was thinking anyway. She'd always known somehow, ever since he was a small boy she had known, and why should it be any different now that he was in high school? Nevertheless, there were other things to talk about besides himself. Above all, Francie and the mystery of her breakdown, which they continued to discuss all through their final days in Vermont. And now that Francie had left the hospital and was checked into another hospital in New Jersey, what was going to happen to her? His mother wasn't sure. All she knew was what Gary had told her, and she couldn't make sense of it. Nothing was clear except that the problems had apparently been growing for some time. Distress about her father, perhaps. Trouble in the marriage, perhaps. Regret over having married too young, perhaps. All of the above or none of them. The puzzling thing was that Francie had always seemed so healthy and stable. A diamond of joyful exuberance, the light of everyone's eye. And now this. Poor Francie, his mother said. My beloved girl is ill. Her family is 3,000 miles away, and there's no one to take care of her. It's up to me, Archie. We'll be home in a couple of days, and once we're there, that's my new job, to make sure Francie gets well. Ferguson asked himself if anyone but his mother could have made such an outrageous declaration, willfully ignoring the possibility that psychiatrists might have any role in Francie's recovery. As if love and the persistence of love were the only reliable cure for a shattered heart. It was such a mad and ignorant thing to say that he couldn't help laughing. And once the laugh came out of his throat, he realized that it was the first time he had laughed since the accident. Good for him, he thought. And good for his mother, too, he thought, whose statement deserved to be laughed at, even though it had been wrong for him to laugh. For the beautiful thing about his mother's words was that she believed them, believed with every bone in her body that she was strong enough to carry the world on her back. The worst part about going home was having to return to school. The hospital had been torture enough, but at least he had felt protected there, walled off from others in the sanctuary of his room, but now he had to walk back into his old world and let everyone see him, and the last thing he wanted was to be seen. It was February, and in preparation for his return to Montclair High, his mother knitted him a pair of special gloves, one normal glove and one with 3 1/3 fingers, shaped to fit the contours of his newly diminished left hand, and a most comfortable pair of gloves they were, made of the softest imported cashmere in an innocuous pale brown, a bland hue that didn't assault the eyes and call attention to itself as a bright color would have, and therefore the gloves were almost unnoticeable. For the rest of the month and halfway into the next, Ferguson wore the left glove indoors at school, claiming he had to do it because of doctor's orders, to protect the hand as it continued to heal. That helped a little bit, as did the stocking cap he wore to hide his patchwork head, which he also had to keep on both outside and inside because of doctor's orders. Once his hair grew back and the bald spots were gone, he would abandon the cap, but it served him well during the early stages of his re-entry, as did the long-sleeved shirts and sweaters he wore to school every day. Typical clothing for February, but also a way to cover the cross-hatched scars on his 2 forearms, which were still an awful shade of red, and because he had been excused from gym class until his doctor declared him fully mended, he didn't have to undress and shower in front of his 11th-grade cronies, which meant that no one saw the scars until they had turned white and were nearly invisible. Those were some of the ploys Ferguson used to make the trial somewhat less difficult for himself. But it was difficult all the same, difficult to return as a piece of damaged goods, as one of his former baseball teammates put it when Ferguson overheard him talking behind his back. And while his friends and teachers all felt sorry for him and tried not to stare at the gloved left hand, not everyone in that school was his friend, and those who actively disliked him were not the least bit dismayed to see the haughty, standoffish Ferguson get his comeuppance. It was his fault that so many people had turned against him in the past few months, since he had more or less abandoned them when he started seeing Amy, declining all Saturday invitations and making himself scarce on Sundays, and the popular little boy whose double portrait still stood in the window of Roseland photo had transformed himself into an outsider. About the only thing that had still kept him connected to the school was the baseball team, and now that baseball was gone, he was beginning to feel gone as well. He continued to show up every day, but every day a little less of him was there. In spite of his estrangement, there were still some friends, still some people he cared about. But apart from dumb Bobby George, his baseball pal and ex-National Geographic sidekick, there was no one he cared about deeply, and why he still should have cared about Bobby was inexplicable to him. Until the night he returned from Vermont, and Bobby came over to his house to welcome him back. And when the young George saw the gloveless, hatless, sweaterless young Ferguson, he started to say something and then burst out crying. And as Ferguson watched his friend give way in that spontaneous gush of infantile tears, he understood that Bobby loved him more than anyone else in the town of Montclair. All his other friends felt sorry for him, but Bobby was the only one who cried. For Bobby's sake, he went to one of the after-school indoor practices to watch the pitcher-catcher drills. It was hard for him to stand in that echoing gym as balls popped back and forth into gloves and bounced across the hardwood floor. But Bobby would be starting behind the plate that season, and he had asked Ferguson to come and see if his throwing had improved over last year, and if it hadn't, to tell him what he was doing wrong. Only players were allowed to be in the gym during those two-hour practice sessions. But even though Ferguson was no longer a member of the team, he still retained certain privileges, which had been granted to him by Coach Martino, whose response to his injuries had been much less restrained than Ferguson had imagined it would be, not holding back as he usually did, but cursing loudly at the goddamn fucked-up thing that had happened, telling Ferguson that he was one of the best players he had ever coached, and that he had been expecting great things from him in his junior and senior years. Then, almost immediately, he started talking about converting him into a pitcher. With an arm like his, he could probably pull it off, Mr. Martino said. And then no one would give a, quote, flying fuck about his batting average or how many home runs he hit. If it was too soon to begin now, why not think about it for next year? Meanwhile, for this year, he could stay with the team as a sort of unofficial assistant coach, hitting fungos at practice, leading the players through their drills and calisthenics, discussing strategy with him on the bench during games. But only if he wanted to, of course. And though Ferguson was tempted to take him up on his offer, he knew he couldn't. He knew it would kill him to be part of the team and not part of the team, a wounded mascot cheering the others on. And so he thanked Mr. Martino and politely said no, explaining that he just wasn't ready. And the old World War II first sergeant, who had fought in the Battle of the Bulge and had belonged to the unit that liberated Dachau, patted Ferguson on the shoulder and wished him luck. Then, by way of conclusion, as he reached out to shake Ferguson's hand for the last time, Coach Martino said, "The only constant in this world is shit, my boy. We're all in it up to our ankles every day, but sometimes, when it gets up to our knees or waists, we just have to pull ourselves out of it and move on. You're moving on, Archie, and I respect you for it, but if you ever happen to change your mind, remember that the door is always open." Bobby George's tears and Sal Martino's always open. Two good things in a world of otherwise all bad things. And yes, Ferguson was moving on now. He had already moved on since he and the coach parted that day. And whether he was headed in the right direction or the wrong direction, the best thing about that second good thing was that no matter where he happened to find himself in the future, he would never forget Mr. Martino's eloquent words about the pervasive, all-enduring power of shit. He mostly kept to himself until the end of winter, going straight home after school every day, sometimes hitching rides with seniors who had cars, sometimes making the 20-minute journey on foot. The house was always empty then, which meant it was quiet, and quiet was what he craved most after spending 6.5 hours at school. A large, enveloping quiet that allowed him to recover from the ordeal of dragging his gloved and hatted body in front of the 2,000 other bodies that filled the hallways and classrooms for those 6.5 hours, and nothing was better than to withdraw into himself again and vanish. His parents generally came home a little past 6, which gave him about 2.5 hours to loll around in his empty fortress. For the most part upstairs in his room, with the door closed, where he could crack open the window and smoke one or two of his mother's forbidden cigarettes, relishing the irony of how the new report from the Surgeon General about the perils of smoking had coincided with his own growing interest in the pleasures of tobacco. And as he smoked his mother's life-threatening Chesterfields, Ferguson would pace around the room, listening to records, alternating between big choral works, Verdi's Requiem, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, and solo compositions by Bach, Pablo Casals, Glenn Gould, or else lie on the bed and read books, working his way through the recent bundle of paperbacks sent to him by Aunt Mildred, the unstinting tour guide of his literary education, who had just mapped out his second visit to France in the past 9 months. And so Ferguson spent those late afternoon hours reading Genet, The Thief's Journal, Gide, The Counterfeiters, Sahot, Tropisms, Breton, Nadia, and Beckett, Molloy. And when he wasn't listening to music or reading books, Ferguson felt lost, so deeply at odds with himself that he sometimes felt he was bursting apart. He wanted to begin writing poems again, but he couldn't concentrate, and every idea that entered his head seemed worthless. The first baseball-playing poet in history could no longer play baseball, and suddenly the poet in him was dying as well. "Help me," he wrote one day. "Why should I help you?" the message to himself continued. "Because I need your help," the first voice answered. "Sorry," the second voice said. "What you need is to stop saying you need help. Start thinking about what I need for a change." "And who are you?" "I'm you, of course. Who else do you think I am?" The one constant in his world that wasn't shit were his nightly talks on the phone with Amy. Her first question to him always was, "How are you doing, Archie?" And every day he would give her the same answer. "Better, a little better than yesterday," which was in fact true, not only because his physical condition was slowly getting better as time went on, but because talking to Amy always seemed to give his old self back to him, as if her voice were the snapping fingers of a hypnotist ordering him to come out of his trance and wake up. No one else had that power over him, and as the weeks passed and Ferguson continued to recover, he began to suspect it had something to do with Amy's reading of the accident, which was unlike anyone else's, for she refused to regard it as a tragedy. And therefore, among the people who loved Ferguson, she was the one who felt least sorry for him. In her view of the world, tragedies were reserved for death and ravaging disabilities, paralysis, brain damage, brutal disfigurement. But the loss of 2 fingers was no more than a trivial matter. And given that a car smashing into a tree should have led to death or brutal disfigurement, one could only rejoice that Ferguson had survived the accident without any tragic consequences. Too bad about baseball, of course, but that was a small debt to pay for the privilege of being alive with only 2 missing fingers. And if he was having trouble writing poems just now, then give poetry a rest for a while and stop worrying about it. And if it turned out that he never managed to write another poem, that would only mean he hadn't been cut out to write poetry in the first place. "You're beginning to sound like Dr. Pangloss," Ferguson said to her one night. "Everything always happens for the best, and this, the best of all possible worlds." "No, not at all," Amy said. "Pangloss is an idiot optimist, and I'm an intelligent pessimist, meaning a pessimist who has occasional flashes of optimism. Nearly everything happens for the worst, but not always, you see. Nothing is ever always, but I'm always expecting the worst, and when the worst doesn't happen, I get so excited, I begin to sound like an optimist. I could have lost you, Archie, and then I didn't. That's all I can think about anymore, how happy I am that I didn't." For the first weeks after he came home from Vermont, he wasn't strong enough to travel into New York on Saturdays. Going back and forth to school from Monday to Friday was just barely feasible. but Manhattan would have been too hard on his aching, stitched-together body, the jostling bus to begin with, but also the long climb up subway stairways, the crowds of people bumping into him in the pedestrian tunnels, and then the impossibility of walking for any length of time through the cold winter streets with Amy. So they reversed the process for all of February and halfway into March, and for 5 Saturdays in a row, Amy visited him in Montclair instead. The new arrangement was short on outward stimulation, but it also had several advantages over the old routine of wandering in and out of bookstores and museums, of sitting in coffee shops, of going to films and plays and parties, the first one being that Ferguson's parents worked on Saturday. And because they worked, the house was empty. And because the house was empty, he and Amy could go upstairs into his room, shut the door, and lie down on the bed with no fear that anyone would discover what they were doing. But still there was fear, at least for Ferguson, who had convinced himself that Amy would want no part of him anymore. And the first time they went into his room in the Montclair house, his fear was no less great than it had been the first time they went into Amy's room in the New York apartment. But once they were on the bed and their clothes began to come off, Amy surprised him by taking hold of his wounded hand and kissing it, slowly kissing it 20 or 30 times. And then she put her mouth against his bandaged left forearm and kissed it 12 times, followed by another 12 kisses on his bandaged right forearm. And then she pulled him down against her chest and began kissing the small bandages on his head, 1 by 1 by 1, each one 6 times, 7 times, 8 times. When Ferguson asked her why she was doing that, she said it was because those were the parts of him she loved best now. "How could she say that?" he replied. "They were disgusting, and how could anyone love what was disgusting?" "Because," Amy said, "those wounds were a memory of what had happened to him, and because he was alive, because he was with her now, what happened to him was also what hadn't happened to him, which meant that the marks on his body were signs of life, and because of that, they weren't disgusting to her, they were beautiful." Ferguson laughed. He wanted to say, "Pangloss to the rescue again," but he didn't say anything. And as he looked into Amy's eyes, he wondered if she was telling the truth. Could she possibly believe what she had just said to him, or was she only pretending to believe it for his sake? And if she didn't believe it, how could he believe her? Because he had to believe her, he decided. Because believing her was the only choice he had. And the truth, the so-called almighty truth, meant nothing when he considered what not believing her would have done to them. Sex for 5 straight Saturdays, sex in the early afternoon, as the thin February light wrapped itself around the edges of the curtains and seeped into the air around their bodies. And then the pleasure of watching Amy climb back into her clothes, knowing that her naked body was inside those clothes, which somehow prolonged the intimacy of sex, even when they weren't having sex. The body he carried around in his mind as they went downstairs to fix themselves some lunch, or listened to records, or watched an old movie on television, or took a short walk around the neighborhood, or he read out loud to her from Pictures from Bruegel by William Carlos Williams, his newly anointed favorite, who had pushed Eliot off the throne following a bloody skirmish with Wallace Stevens. Sex for 5 straight Saturdays, but also the chance to talk face to face again, after the long-distance phone conversations during the school week. And on 3 of those Saturdays, Amy hung around long enough to be there when his parents came home from work, which led to 3 dinners with just the 4 of them, sitting together in the kitchen. His mother, so much happier now that he was with Amy and not that drunken Belgian girl, and his father amused by her volubility and offbeat remarks, as when, to cite one example from late February, which had been the month of the Beatles' conquest of America and Cassius Clay's triumph over Sonny Liston, the 2 big subjects everyone was talking about. Amy made the nutty but insightful comment that John Lennon and the new heavyweight champion were one and the same person divided up into 2 different bodies, young men in their early 20s who had captured the attention of the world in precisely the same way, by not taking themselves seriously, by having a gift for saying the most obnoxious things with a boldness and theatricality that made people laugh. I am the greatest. We're more popular than Jesus Christ. And when Amy repeated those ridiculous but unforgettable statements, Ferguson's father suddenly started to laugh, not only because Amy had done spot-on imitations of Lennon's Liverpudlian burr and Clay's Kentucky drawl, but because she had imitated their facial expressions as well. And once Ferguson's father had stopped laughing, he said, "You've got a good point there, Amy. Wise guys with fast tongues and even faster minds. I like that." Ferguson had no idea if his parents were aware of how he and Amy spent those Saturday mornings and afternoons alone in the house. He suspected his mother might have been onto them. She had come home unannounced on the second Saturday to retrieve a sweater and had caught them smoothing out the covers on the bed, which could have meant she had discussed it with his father. But even if they did know, neither one of them said a word about it, since it was manifestly clear by then that Amy Schneiderman was a positive force in their boy's life, a one-girl emergency team who was single-handedly nursing him through the agonizing adjustment to his post-accident world. And therefore, they encouraged them to be together as often as possible. And even though money was particularly tight just then, they never objected to the high cost of the long-distance calls, which had more than quadrupled their monthly telephone bill. "That girl is good stuff, Archie," his mother said to him one day, and as she watched her ex-boss's granddaughter minister to her son, she herself was ministering to her niece Francie by going to the hospital every afternoon at 4 o'clock for a one-hour visit, where she steadfastly carried on with her all-love and nothing-but-love treatments. Ferguson paid close attention to her nightly reports about Francie's progress, but he kept worrying that his cousin would say something to his mother about the squeaking bed and how angry she had been at him on the morning of the crash, which could have led to some unpleasant questions from his mother that he would have been compelled to lie about in order to cover up his embarrassment. But when he finally found the courage to raise the subject himself, asking his mother what Francie had told her about the accident, his mother claimed that Francie had never mentioned it. Was that true? He asked himself. Could Francie have blanked out the crash? Or was his mother merely playing dumb about the argument because she didn't want to upset him? "And what about my hand?" Ferguson asked. "Does she know about that?" "Yes," his mother said. "Gary told her." "Why would he do that? It seems rather heartless, don't you think?" "Because she has to know. She'll be getting out of the hospital soon, and no one wants her to be shocked when she sees you again." She was discharged after 3 weeks of rest and therapy, and although there would be further breakdowns and hospitalizations in the years to come, she was back on her feet for now, still wearing a sling around her left arm because the clavicle had been slow in mending, but altogether radiant, as Ferguson's mother said after her final visit to the hospital. And when the sling came off a week later, and Francie invited Ferguson and his parents for Sunday brunch at her house in West Orange, he found her looking radiant as well, fully restored, no longer the harried, spooked-out woman she had been during that catastrophic weekend in Vermont. It was a fraught moment for both of them, facing each other for the first time since the accident. And when Francie looked at his hand and saw what the accident had done to it, she teared up and threw her arms around him, blubbering out an apology that made Ferguson understand, for the first time since the accident, how much he secretly blamed Francie for what had happened to him. That even if it wasn't her fault, even if her final glance at him in the car had been the glance of a mad person, someone no longer in control of her thoughts, she was the one who had smashed the car into the tree. And while he wanted to forgive her for everything, he couldn't quite do it. Not all the way down in the deepest part of himself. And even as his mouth was saying all the right words, assuring her that he didn't hold it against her and all was forgiven, he knew that he was lying and would always hold it against her, that the accident would stand between them for the rest of their lives. He turned 17 on March 3rd. Several days after that, he went to the local branch of the DMV and took the road test for his New Jersey driver's license. Demonstrating his skill at the wheel with the smoothly negotiated turns, the steady pressure he applied to the gas pedal, as if you were putting your foot on an uncooked egg, his father had told him, his mastery at braking and driving in reverse, and last of all, his understanding of the maneuvers involved in parallel parking, the tight squeeze operation that was the downfall of so many would-be motorists. Ferguson had taken hundreds of tests over the years, but passing this one was far more important to him than anything he had accomplished at school. This one was for real, and once he had the license in his pocket, it would have the power to unlock doors and let him out of his cage. He knew his parents were struggling, that business was down for both of them, and the family's resources were pinched. Not yet hard times, perhaps, but getting close, getting closer by the month. Blue Cross Blue Shield had covered the bulk of the cost for his stay in the Vermont hospital, but there had been some cash expenditures as well, out-of-pocket deductibles and sundry long-distance telephone charges, along with the money spent on the motel room and his mother's rented car, which couldn't have been easy on them, walking out into their rainy day with torn umbrellas and no shoes on. And so, when March 3rd came around, and the only birthday present he received from his parents was a toy car, a miniature replica of a white 1958 Chevy Impala, he interpreted it as a kind of joke present, at once a good luck charm for the driving exam he was about to take, and an admission from his parents that they couldn't afford anything better. Oh well, he thought, it actually was rather funny, and since both of his parents were smiling, he smiled back at them and said, "Thank you," too distracted to pay attention to what his mother said next. "Fear not, Archie. Out of little acorns do mighty oaks grow." 6 days later, an oak appeared in the driveway in the form of a full-sized car, a mammoth replica of the acorn that now sat on Ferguson's desk as an all-purpose paperweight, or almost a replica, since the white Chevy Impala parked in the driveway had been built in 1960, not 1958, with two doors instead of the four doors in the model, and both of Ferguson's parents were sitting in the car and honking the horn together, honking and honking until their son came down from his room to see what the commotion was about. His mother explained that they were planning to give it to him on the 3rd, but the car had needed some work, and the repairs had taken a little longer than expected. She hoped he liked it, she said. They had thought about letting him choose one on his own, but then it wouldn't have been a surprise, and the fun of giving a present like this was the surprise. Ferguson said nothing. His father frowned at him and asked, "Well, Archie, what do you think? Do you like it or not?" Yes, he liked it. Of course he liked it. How could he not like it? He liked the car so much he wanted to get down on his knees and kiss it. "But how did you come up with the money?" he finally asked. "It must have cost a lot." "Less than you'd think," his father said. "Only $650. "Before or after the repairs?" "Before, and even $800 after." "That's a lot," Ferguson said. "Way too much. You shouldn't have done it." "Don't be ridiculous," his mother said. "I've taken 100 portraits in the past 6 months, and now that the book is finished, what do you think is hanging on the walls of my famous men and women?" "Ah, I see," Ferguson said. "Not just the grant, but bonus money, too. How much did you charge them for the pleasure of looking at themselves?" $150 a pop," his mother said. Ferguson made a little whistling sound, nodding his head in appreciation. "A cool $15,000, his father added, just in case Ferguson was having trouble with the arithmetic. "You see," his mother said, "we're not going to the poorhouse, Archie, at least not today, and probably not tomorrow either, so shut up, get into your car, and take us somewhere, all right?" Thus began the season of the car. For the first time in his life, Ferguson was the master of his own comings and goings, the sovereign ruler of the spaces that surrounded him. With no god before him now but a six-cylinder internal combustion engine, which asked nothing more of him than a full tank of gas and an oil change every 3,000 miles. Throughout the spring and into the early days of summer, he drove the car to school every morning, most often with Bobby George next to him up front, and sometimes with a third person in back. and when school let out at 3:15, he no longer went straight home to sequester himself in his small bedroom, but climbed back into the car and drove for an hour or two without purpose or destination, drove for the pure satisfaction of driving. And after not knowing where he wanted to go for the first minutes or quarter hours of those drives, he often found himself meandering up to the South Mountain Reservation, the only patch of wilderness in all of Essex County, acres and acres of forests and hiking trails, a sanctuary that harbored owls and hummingbirds and hawks, a place of a million butterflies. And when he reached the top of the mountain, he would get out of the car and look down at the immense valley below, town after town filled with houses and factories and schools and churches and parks, a view that encompassed more than 20 million people, 1/10 of the population of the United States, for it went all the way to the Hudson River and across into the city. And at the farthest limit of what Ferguson could see from the top ledge of the mountain, there were the tall buildings of New York, the Manhattan skyscrapers jutting out from the horizon like tiny stalks of grass. And once, as he looked at Amy's city, he got it into his head that he should go see Amy herself. And suddenly he was in the car again, impulsively driving to New York through the mounting rush hour traffic. And when he arrived at the Schneiderman's apartment 1:20 later, Amy, who was in the middle of doing her homework, was so surprised to see him when she opened the door that she let out a shriek. "Archie," she said, "what are you doing here?" "I'm here to kiss you," Ferguson said. "Just one kiss, and then I have to be off." "Just one," she said. "Just one." So Amy opened her arms and let him kiss her. And just as they were in the middle of their one kiss, Amy's mother walked into the entranceway and said, "Good God, Amy, what are you doing?" "What does it look like, Ma?" Amy said, as she jerked away her lips from Ferguson's mouth and looked at her mother. "I'm kissing the coolest guy on two legs." It was Ferguson's finest moment, the very pinnacle of his adolescent aspirations, the grand and foolish gesture he had dreamed of so often, but had never found the courage to try. And because he didn't want to spoil it by going back on his word, he bowed to Amy and her mother and then headed for the stairs. Out on the street, he said to himself, without the car, it never would have happened. A car had nearly killed him in January, and now, just 2 months later, a car was giving his life back to him. On Monday, March 23rd, he decided not to wear the hat to school. And since his hair had grown back by then, and his head looked more or less as it had always looked before the Vermont scalping, no one mentioned the absence of the hat, except for 3 or 4 girls in his French class, among them Margaret O'Mara, who had once sent him a secret love note when they were in the 6th grade. On Thursday morning, the weather was so warm for that time of year that he decided to dispense with the glove as well. Again, no one said much of anything. And of all the people in his dwindling circle of friends, only Bobby George asked to take a close look at it, which Ferguson reluctantly allowed him to do, sticking out his left arm and letting Bobby take hold of the hand, which he then brought up to within 6 inches of his face and examined with the rapt scrutiny of a veteran surgeon, or perhaps a young, brainless child, it was hard to tell with Bobby, turning the hand back and forth and gently rubbing his fingers against the injured areas. And when he finally let go of it and Ferguson dropped his arm back down to his side, Bobby said, "It's looking real good, Archie, all healed up now and back to its old color." Ever since the accident, people had been telling him stories about famous men who had also lost fingers and then gone on to flourish in life. Among them, the baseball pitcher Mordecai Brown, better known as Three Finger Brown, who had won 239 games in a 14-year career and was elected to the Hall of Fame, and the silent film comedian Harold Lloyd, who had lost the thumb and forefinger of his right hand in a property bomb explosion, and still he managed to hang from the hands of that gigantic clock and perform 1,000 other impossible stunts. Ferguson tried to take heart from those inspirational narratives, to see himself as a proud member of the fraternity of 8-fingered men. But rah-rah stuff of that ilk tended to leave him cold, or embarrass him, or repulse him with its treacly optimism, and yet still and all, with or without the examples of those other men to guide him, he was slowly coming to terms with the altered shape of his hand, beginning to get used to it. And when he finally took off the glove on March 26th, he figured the worst was behind him. What he failed to consider, however, was how comforting the glove had been to him, how much he had depended on it as a shield against the squirming horrors of self-consciousness. And now that the hand was naked again, now that he was trying to act as if everything had returned to normal, he fell into the habit of sticking his left hand into his pocket whenever he was with other people, which at school meant nearly all the time. And the demoralizing thing about this new habit was that he wasn't aware of what he was doing. The gesture was made out of pure reflex, entirely independent of his will. And it was only when he had to take the hand out of the pocket for one reason or another that he understood the hand had been in the pocket in the first place. No one outside the school was aware of this tic, not Amy, not his mother and father, not his grandparents, since it wasn't difficult to be brave around the people who cared about him. But Ferguson had turned into a coward at school and was beginning to despise himself for it. And yet, how could he stop himself from doing something he didn't even know he was doing? There seemed to be no answer to the problem, which was yet another instance of the old and intractable mind-body problem. In this case, a mindless body part acting as if it had a mind of its own. But then, after a month of fruitless searching, an answer finally came to him, an altogether practical answer. And one by one, he gathered up the four pairs of pants he wore to school, gave them to his mother, and asked her to sew up the front and back left pockets on each pair. On April 11th, Amy received her acceptance letter from Barnard. No one who knew her was surprised, but for several months, she had been anguishing over the 81 she had been given in Algebra 2 trigonometry last year, which had pulled down her overall average from 95 to 93, and wondering if her SAT scores weren't just a trifle too low, 1375 instead of the 1450 she had been gunning for. And whenever Ferguson had tried to reassure her during those anxious months of waiting, she would tell him that nothing was certain in this life, that the world doled out disappointments as quickly and eagerly as a politician could shake hands. And because she didn't want to be disappointed, she was preparing herself to be disappointed. And therefore, when the happy news arrived at last, she wasn't happy so much as relieved. But Ferguson was happy, not just for Amy, but for himself, above all for himself, since there had been a number of backup choices in case Barnard had turned her down, each one in a city not named New York. And Ferguson had been living in dread that she would land in one of those far-off places like Boston or Chicago or Madison, Wisconsin, which would have made everything so complicated and lonely for him. Seeing her only a few times a year, the rushed holiday returns to West 75th Street, and then gone again. 9 long months with little or no contact, writing letters to her that she would be too busy to answer, and slowly and inevitably they would have drifted apart. Nothing could have stopped her from meeting someone else. The college boys would have been circling around her, and sooner or later she would have fallen for one of them, a 20 or 21-year-old history major civil rights activist who would have made her forget all about poor Ferguson, who still hadn't graduated from high school. And then the letter from Barnard arrived, and he no longer had to contemplate the grim details of what might have been. Ferguson was still young, but he was old enough to have learned that worst nightmares sometimes became real. Brothers robbing brothers, presidents shot down by assassins' bullets, cars crashing into trees, and that sometimes they didn't, as with the crisis 2 years earlier, when the world was supposed to have ended but didn't, or as with Amy's going off to college, which could have taken her away from New York but didn't. And now that she would be spending the next 4 years in New York, Ferguson understood that when the time came for him to go to college, he would have to head to New York as well. The baseball season had started by then, but Ferguson did everything he could not to think about it. He avoided going to the games, and whatever he knew about the team came from his conversations with Bobby George on their morning rides to school. Andy Malone, who had taken over Ferguson's spot at third base, was apparently having trouble adjusting to his new position and had cost the team a couple of wins with late-inning errors. Ferguson felt sorry for him and everyone else on the team, but not too sorry, not sorry enough to prevent him from feeling somewhat glad as well. For much as it pained him to admit it, there was a perverse satisfaction in knowing that the team was less good without him. As for Bobby, nothing to worry about as usual. He had always been good, but now he was the best player on the squad, a power-hitting catcher who could field as well as he hit. And when he finally talked Ferguson into going to a home game against Columbia High School in the second week of May, Ferguson was astonished by how enormously Bobby had improved. A single, a double, and a three-run homer, along with two runners thrown out trying to steal second base. The snot-clogged little boy, who had breathed through his mouth and sucked his thumb, was now a 6'2" adolescent, a muscular, quick-footed hulk of more than 200 pounds, who looked like a full-grown man on the field and played with an intelligence that was nothing less than bewildering to Ferguson. For Bobby George was a blockhead at all pursuits that were not baseball or football or laughing at dirty jokes, and the only reason why he wasn't flunking half his classes was because his parents had hired a tutor from Montclair State to help keep his average from dropping below a C, which was the academic minimum required to participate in interscholastic sports. Put him on a ball field, however, and he played smart. And now that Ferguson had seen how good Bobby had become, there was no need to torture himself by going to another game that spring. Maybe next year, he told himself, but for now, it still hurt too much. Summer was approaching, and with the business of college finally off the table for her, Amy was talking politics again, pouring out her ideas to Ferguson in long conversations about SNCC, CORE, and the direction of the movement, bitterly frustrated that she was too young to go down south to take part in the Mississippi Summer Project that was being organized during the last months of the school year. The three-pronged initiative launched by SNCC that involved the recruitment of a small army of college students from the north. 1,000 extra pairs of hands to help with 1. A voter registration drive for the disenfranchised Negroes of the state. 2. The running of the Freedom Schools that would be set up for Negro children in dozens of towns and small cities. And 3. The founding of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which would elect a slate of alternative delegates to go to the convention in Atlantic City at the end of August in order to unseat the all-white, racist delegation of the regular Democrats. Amy would have given anything to go down into that danger zone of violence and bigotry, to put herself on the line for the cause. But 19 was the cutoff age, and she wasn't eligible to apply, which was all to the good from Ferguson's perspective. For much as he believed in the cause himself, a summer without Amy would have been intolerable to him. Many intolerable things occurred in the months that followed, but not to them, not directly to them. And in spite of their summer jobs as clerk at the 8th Street Bookshop, Amy, and staff member at Stanley's TV and radio, Ferguson, they managed to see each other often, not just on the weekends, but on many weeknights as well, with Ferguson driving into the city the moment he got off from work, picking up Amy at the bookstore, and then on to hamburgers at Joe Jr.'s and a movie at the Bleecker Street Cinema, or a walk through Washington Square, or a naked tumble in the apartment of one of Amy's absent friends. Free to go wherever they wanted now because of Ferguson's car, the freedom car of that freedom summer, the Saturdays and Sundays when they would drive out to Jones Beach, or drive up north to the country, or drive down to the Jersey Shore, a summer of big thoughts and ferocious love and immense pain, which began so encouragingly when the Civil Rights Bill was passed by the Senate on June 19th, and then, immediately afterward, just 72 hours later, the intolerable things began to happen. On June 22nd, 3 of the young men who had joined the Mississippi Summer Project were reported missing. Andrew Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney had left the project's Ohio Training Center ahead of the other students in order to investigate the bombing of a church, and had not been heard from since the day of their departure. There was no question that they had been murdered, beaten, and tortured, and killed by white segregationists out to terrorize the invading horde of Yankee radicals who were plotting to destroy their way of life. But no one knew where the bodies were, and not one white person in the state of Mississippi seemed to care. Amy wept when she heard the news. On July 16th, the day Barry Goldwater won the Republican nomination for president in San Francisco, a white cop shot and killed a black teenager in Harlem. And Amy wept again when James Powell's death was answered by six straight nights of rioting and looting in Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant, with the New York police shooting live bullets over the heads of people standing on rooftops and throwing stones and garbage down on them in the streets. Not the fire hoses and dogs used to disperse black mobs in the South, but real bullets. And Amy wept, not only because she finally understood that racism was just as strong in the North as it was in the South, just as strong in her own city, but because she also understood that her innocent idealism was dead, that her dream of a colorblind America in which blacks and whites stood together was no more than stupid, wishful thinking. And not even Bayard Rustin, the man who had organized the March on Washington just 11 months earlier, had the least bit of influence anymore. And when he stood in front of the crowd in Harlem and begged them to stop the violence so no one would be hurt or killed, the crowd shouted him down and called him an Uncle Tom. Peaceful resistance had lost its meaning. Martin Luther King was yesterday's news, and black power had become the supreme gospel. And so great was that power that within a matter of months, the word Negro had been erased from the American lexicon. On August 4th, the bodies of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were discovered in an earth dam near Philadelphia, Mississippi, and the photographs of their half-buried corpses lying in the mud at the bottom of the dam were so horrible and disturbing to look at that Ferguson turned away his head and groaned. The next day, word was released that two U.S. destroyers patrolling the Gulf of Tonkin had been attacked by North Vietnamese PT boats, or so it was stated in the official government report. And on August 7th, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, giving Johnson the power to, quote, take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression, unquote. The war was on, and Amy was no longer weeping. She had made up her mind about Johnson now, and she was furious, so exalted in her anger that Ferguson was almost tempted to crack a joke to see if she would ever smile again. It's going to be big, Archie, she said, bigger than Korea, bigger than anything since World War II, and just be glad you won't be part of it. And why is that, Dr. Pangloss? Ferguson asked. Because one-thumbed men don't get drafted. Thank God.